Welcome to Securing Your Legacy, Succession Planning for Law Firms. I'm Samantha Seves, and I am one of the co-membership chairs of the Barrister Section of the Beverly Hills Bar Association, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Daniel O'Reilly. Daniel is a founder and managing partner of O'Reilly & Roach LLP. Based in Los Angeles, he is a business and legal ethics lawyer for California law firms. He counsels and advises firms on strategic business issues, including developing and drafting partnership agreements and other firm organizing documents, developing and documenting compensation systems, attorney promotion systems, succession planning, developing and executing law firm startup planning, and growth planning. We can't wait to see what he has prepared to show us today. Let's get started.
Thank you, Sam. Today we're going to consider what I think is one of the most important and also one of the most overlooked aspects of law firm ownership. And by law firm ownership, I mean equity partners, and that is succession planning. What does that mean exactly? It means having a plan for another group of lawyers or another firm or another lawyer to take over your practice as you step back for whatever reason, and that can be planned or unplanned. Assuming you own the firm or the majority of the firm or a significant stake in a law firm, this is the path for you also to get full value of your ownership interest, or at least to maximize the value to you and your family if you leave. So we think of two types of succession planning. The first is the plan that ensures that your practice continues and your clients are protected in the event that you're unable to practice law for some period of time, planned or unplanned. The second is the plan that ensures a smooth transition of your law practice and your firm when the time comes for you to step back from practicing law. Maybe you're going to retire, maybe you're going to go write the novel that you've always wanted to write, or maybe you're going to do some other thing besides being a lawyer at a law firm. When that happens, there are things that you can do to ensure that you protect your clients and you transition the firm over to a new regime, but also maximize the value for you and your family that you get from something that you built over a lifetime and a career. Lawyers tend to put off succession planning. They're busy with client matters, and that always comes first. And even with good intentions, law firm planning can take a back seat. That is 100% normal. So for every busy lawyer who are our clients, it is good intentions, and we try to structure the process so that we can overcome obstacles to planning, which we'll touch on at the end of the talk today. But in the first instance, one of the things that we want to question is, why should you worry about succession planning at all? And there are some very compelling reasons why you should focus on this and plan ahead. Last year, the State Bar of California's Committee on Professional Responsibility and Conduct, that's COPRAC, issued its formal opinion 2024-209 that's in the materials. This opinion details a lawyer's duty to engage in succession planning, and the takeaway of it is that the rules require you to assess whether succession planning is required for your firm. And again, we're in category one of succession planning, which is how to protect your clients in the event that you have an unexpected interruption in your practice, and how to ensure that the firm continues its operations. There is no single California rule of professional conduct that explicitly requires a lawyer to adopt a succession plan, but there are multiple rules that would be impossible to meet without a succession plan. In other words, an interruption to your practice without a succession plan almost certainly would lead to a violation of multiple rules. Specifically, Rule 1.1, the duty of competence. Rule 1.3, diligence. The duty of loyalty to your clients and making sure their interests are protected. Rule 1.4, the duty to communicate. Rule 116, the duty to avoid reasonably foreseeable prejudice when terminating a representation. Rule 115, safeguarding funds and property of clients. Rule 5.1, the duty to supervise others and ensure compliance with the rules. There's a laundry list of rules, and it's detailed in this opinion, which is really worth a read because it's not generally considered to be required But the opinion does illustrate how it would not be possible to really meet the obligations that you have under these rules and the other duties that you have to clients if you don't have the su succession plan. And again, the takeaway is to meet these obligations, you have to engage in an assessment of whether a succession plan is required for your practice. Examine whether and what you need to do in advance to meet your obligations under the rules. That might require you to arrange in advance how client matters are handled. That's a baseline. Arrange in advance how client files would be returned. Arrange in advance how funds and property belonging to clients will be returned to them. If you don't have a succession plan, it's very easy to imagine scenarios where your client's interests are unprotected, their rights are prejudiced, and the firm suffers. And when you come back, if it's a temporary unplanned absence, it will really be a mess. So the first answer to the question why I worry about succession planning is really the rules require it. And they don't require you to do something specific in terms of what the plan should be, but they absolutely require you to assess whether you can meet these obligations if you had a planned or an unplanned absence from your practice. And just in general, it's very good business to put in contingent plans for the protection of your clients in the event that you are not available. But there are other reasons, more practical reasons, that we worry about succession planning. And these have to do with the second category of succession planning, which is if you're a firm owner, a substantial owner of a firm, or an exclusive owner of a firm, getting value for that law firm ownership interest really requires you to plan ahead. And it doesn't happen overnight. It's not very straightforward, but it can be done if you have the right plan. And when we say getting full value for your partnership interest, what we mean is a smooth transition of your practice to others, and you are bought out, your interest is purchased or otherwise compensated. You move on to other things, whether that's retirement or some other thing. And if you don't have a plan and you are deciding that you're just going to wind down your firm, you're really giving up a substantial value of something that you have built over many, many years in your career. And this is oddly something that we see lawyers do. People just take a sort of soft landing approach to their firms and their succession plans. Maybe you take fewer clients over the years. Maybe you wind down some of the staff obligations that you have, shrink the operations. But in doing that, you're really giving up a substantial asset. And the value that you have created in the firm is the ongoing revenue. So if you wind that down slowly over time, yes, things will get easier for you in life, and maybe that's the path for you. And if it is, that's okay. But if you want to get full value out of your firms and your interest in the firm, you really do need to have a plan for how you're going to transition out. More to the point, not just protecting your own financial interests, although that's a significant interest. At the firm, you have employees, you have other attorneys, you have colleagues and peers. And protecting them and their futures really requires having a succession plan in place so that you don't simply one day decide that you're going to wind the practice down and they're left to fend for themselves. In many firms, it's the case that one or two people run the firm and they're the only people who know how to run the firm. So part of what we also think of as a reason to worry about succession planning is really creating a future for the people that work with you, your trusted colleagues, your employees, people who have served you over many years, and who will be the future of the firm if it's handled properly, but who will really be left in the lurch if it's not. And for many lawyers and staff, sudden interruptions with no plan and succession is an extremely unwelcome development in their own careers that easily can be avoided. So, why should you worry about succession planning? Well, one, the rules require you to take a look at this. That's one. Two, if you want to get full value for what you have created, you need to plan ahead. And three, to protect your colleagues, your employees, your peers of the firm, and to continue the legacy of the firm that you've created, you need a plan in place. The good news is it's not really terribly difficult to think through that plan. We do this with clients every single day, and we encourage our clients to handle this and think about this as they would any client problem that their clients present, which they do all day, every day. In other words, lawyers put this off because it's very extremely important, but it's not urgent, and everything else on their desk is urgent. And so they solve those client problems first. But the reality is, you should think of this as just another matter where you bring your best lawyer mind to the problem and think through what these options are. Now, you don't have to think about dying if that's something that makes you uncomfortable. You can think about retiring and going off to do whatever it is that you would rather do instead of practicing law. There's another element of this that we stress, which is when the time comes that it's too late for you to leave, it's way too late. You don't necessarily know when that time is going to come. And we certainly have lawyers who are fully functional and bright well into their 80s or later. And there are other folks for whom issues arise much sooner than that, but you won't necessarily know. And if you're a lawyer, you need a plan in order to reduce risk. That's what you do for your clients every single day. And this is what we do for our clients who are lawyers. It takes a bit of prodding to get lawyers to think about their own plans in that way, but we really encourage clients to look at it as with their lawyer brains, just as any other problem to solve. What would the goals be of your succession plan? This is where you start to think about, what do I actually want to achieve here? We're obviously looking at an exit for the firm. You're going to leave the firm someday. And as I mentioned before, one of the main goals you have if you're a majority interest owner or an exclusive owner of a firm is maximizing the value of what is probably one of your largest assets in your life. That seems intuitive, but again, consider what will happen if you don't have a succession plan. Your family or your spouse will have to deal with, in some fashion, handing over the transition of the firm. The lawyers at the firm will be taken by surprise in the event that you're unexpectedly gone. The staff will be taken by surprise. People may or may not have the qualifications to pick it up and run it. You won't have trained any of them to do that. And it's very unlikely that the firm will survive. Another part of our practice is dissolving firms when a principal lawyer has departed unexpectedly, and that is a mess. And it's easily avoided if you just plan ahead. So set the goals of the succession plan. The one goal, if you're a majority owner, is to maximize the value to you or other founders or other equity partners of a transition. Another goal that you may have, and this part of the plan that you'll develop, which is creating a lasting legacy for the firm to continue this thing that you've built over the course of your entire career, the practice that you have. For that to be handed off to people who you've trained, and for it to continue, whether it's in your own name or a different name, but the practice continues and the clients are protected. And that is a lawyer legacy. That is a significant interest that lawyers should have when they're thinking through these succession planning goals. The other goals would include creating some type of a tiered or a graduated exit for yourself or your colleagues. If you plan ahead, you can step back slowly in the way that makes sense for you. If you don't plan ahead and something unexpected happens, it'll be an extremely sudden disruption to the practice. So over a period of time, you can create a plan that fits the way in which you want to step back. Maybe you want to be in charge of the firm up to the last day that you're there. Maybe you don't want to be in charge tomorrow, but you still want to be practicing law or being a big brain at the firm and walking around. Maybe you want to do just business development and talking to clients, but not the other aspects of it. You can define that role for yourself at the firm. And you can plot out the timing for that, which is most important in the plan. And one of the goals really should be to think through and to create the specifics around how you want to exit in an orderly way. Another important goal for a succession plan is really to reward the hard work of colleagues by transitioning ownership and control of the firm to them. These are folks who have worked at a firm, made it successful with you over probably many years. In some instances, it will be the only place they've ever worked. And in some instances, it will be the only professional home that they can imagine. And it's a significant process for a law firm to bring people up to an ownership level. And that's not just necessarily training them to how to run the firm, but that is a critical part of it. Because as a founder or an equity partner or somebody who owns a significant part of a firm, you probably are the only one or one of a few people who actually knows how it runs, knows how decisions are made, knows what it made it successful, knows what it should be doing in the future in terms of strategy to keep it successful. So rewarding the hard work of your colleagues is a critically important goal of a succession plan. And again, what we're doing in this process is putting the very huge, undefined problem of how do I wind down my practice, my role in the practice, and hand it over to other people. Well, just like anything that you would advise your clients to do, it happens in a logical, orderly way. We first figure out what are the goals we're trying to achieve, and they'll be different for every lawyer. There will be lawyers who say, I don't want to do this if I'm not in charge. There will be lawyers who say, I have a team of people right below me who are excellent, talented, ready to take the next step. It's much more likely that nobody can replace you if you're a founder of the firm and you started the firm and you've been with it for the duration, because that's an identity that if you're not a founder, you're unlikely to ever have. However, you may have four or five or more people at the next level below you who can do pieces of what you do and may have strengths in those areas and can be trained to fill in the gaps of what they don't know about the specifics of your firm. So you do business development, you manage the firm, you do recruiting, practice development, and all the other functions that a founder or an equity partner is called upon to do. And that doesn't happen overnight. It didn't happen overnight for you, and it won't for others. But there will be people who have a specific strength in originating new work. There will be people who have a specific strength in managing the firm. There will be people who have a specific strength in practice development, meaning how we become better lawyers in a planned way. And those are all three things that are critically important to the firm's development. If you plan it out correctly, you can identify and plan to develop those lawyers at the next level who can replace those functions for equity partners who are exiting. And that's really what we're talking about in terms of a plan. Now, your goals will definitely diverge from others at the firm. And in that instance, part of what we're doing by identifying the goals is to see whether there are any tension points where you want to leave tomorrow, but nobody's ready to take over. Or you want to stay for a long time, but other people are ready to move up. And the process of identifying goals is really also identifying any kind of tensions that we think might emerge based on what you want to do compared to the reality of your firm actually on the ground. Okay, so we've identified some goals. You have identified why you should think about succession planning, and then you've thought through some of the things that will be specific to you, the goals, and put that into a framework for what works and what doesn't in reality at the firm. And starting to think through goals, how achievable they are at your firm, is really the process of planning. Based on the goals, what is the right structure for your firm succession plan? This is where most lawyers just blue screen and have a blank stare. And it makes sense that you wouldn't necessarily know about this because it's not something that people talk about very often. It's certainly not something that anybody ever trained you to do, certainly not in law school or anywhere else. And it's a little bit like a wedding. If you do it correctly, you only have to do it once. So ultimately, what we are talking about is three broad categories. And again, this is probably new to most lawyers, but we're thinking about three ways that you can exit a firm. You're going to sell to another law firm, probably with a recruiter or a law firm broker. Or you are going to sell to an internal group, lawyer candidates of people that you've worked with and people that you've trained and that you will train to sort of take over your role as that plan develops. That's a second option. And a third option is you're going to merge the practice with another firm, joining a larger platform. And then finally, another a fourth option, and we'll come back to talk through the pros and cons of these, is you create a law-related business that actually runs firm operations that can be sold, including to non-lawyers. And then what remains at the firm is something that only licensed people can do, which is actually practice law. So let's come back to some of the pros and cons about these four structures. The first was sell to another law firm, potentially with a recruiter or a law firm broker. That can be a high value if you find the right buyer. Let's say you do something in California that an East Coast firm, does in the East Coast or elsewhere and wants to have duplicated in California. And many firms want to have a presence in California for obvious reasons. It's an enormous economy, but also it means coast-to-coast coverage. It means that they're in every major market. And if you find the right buyer, it can be a significant value to you. Now, if you look at these types of opportunities, and you've probably had these opportunities multiple times over the years to join other firms, and the deal is essentially come here and be a lawyer and we'll pay you compensation, but you're not going to get anything out of the actual value that you've created at your firm because that's just going to wind up. And that's what you really want to avoid. You're not looking for a new job. You're essentially looking for somebody who could actually pay you a premium because what they want something that complements that you have their business. Client retention in these circumstances can be much more difficult. Clients may not want a larger firm if that's what happens. They may not want a different firm. The fees at the new firm can be much higher. Service can be different or less personal. They viewed you as their personal lawyers. And then all of a sudden, you're not the personal lawyer anymore. And they don't have a particular reason to feel connected to the firm. The clients chose you, and they didn't choose whoever it is that buys you or wherever you go. And so that's going to be a client retention issue. So true for lawyers at the firm. They may not want to be at a larger firm if that's what happens, or they may not want to be at a new firm and they may want to practice on their own and they may take that opportunity to decide that it's time to try that. These can be a better fit for certain types of practices, in particular, contingent fee practices can be easier to transfer over to different firms, and it's easier to say, get paid for the value of those cases because it isn't just the straight hourly work that you get from working as a lawyer on a daily basis. Some practices can be very difficult to transition to new firms. If you have a highly personalized trial practice that's based on your reputation as a star trial lawyer, it's really unlikely that somebody else is going to step in and be you. That doesn't mean it can't be done, but it just means that it's not going to be plug and play at some other firm. It's also possible that in these circumstances, the practice that you have could be a mismatch for the new firm in terms of expenses, what it takes to run the firm, how you actually produce the revenue and the overhead that is required. The expense load is rarely, a match at a different firm. It's probably why you started the firm or worked at the firm in its current form in the first place. And it can be very difficult to find a buyer at the right price. Many firms, as I mentioned, don't value this. They just want to plug you in as an additional equity partner and say, we'll pay you compensation. But if you find the right buyer, that first option of selling to a different firm can be a good option. It provides a home for your lawyers, staff, and others, depending. And the clients may be happy with it, and it might bring opportunities in the short term. And if the firm is willing to compensate you for what you're bringing, it could be an exit that makes sense. The second category is selling to internal lawyer candidates at your firm, people that you have trained and worked with over many years. And you would update and train them over a period of time to own and manage the firm if there are things that they just don't know about, which is probable. Selling to internal lawyer candidates is great. It is a great way to maintain the legacy of the firm, the culture of the firm. It's best for other lawyers of the firm because they move up. It gives you the opportunity to have a planned departure. It gives the staff continuity. The clients feel comfortable with it if you do it correctly and over time. There are challenges, though, to this. I mean, one is it's rare to have the right internal candidates who are working for you and have for a long period of time and all of a sudden have to take an entrepreneurial bent and become a sort of a lawyer owner mentality relatively quickly. And sometimes it can be very difficult to properly identify them. You may have them at your firm, in which case it'll work, and you may not, in which case it won't. And some practices call for the full development of lawyers into kind of lawyer owners. And by that, I mean they're managing client relationships, they're getting client work, they're taking part in firm management, they are taking part in professional development. And some practices don't require that. They just really rely on legal expertise, work as a lawyer, I'll handle all the rest. In the latter example, it's really unlikely that you're going to be able to turn somebody from a service lawyer into an owner. It's possible, but it'll be a challenge and it will take longer. So identifying suitable candidates can be a challenge, and then properly incentivizing them can be a challenge. What are they going to get out of this besides moving up and headaches and a bunch of liabilities? What does the future look like for them? And you have to have a plan where they could see a future that looks way better than what they have. Usually it's after you're gone. And then, of course, you have to train them to do the things that you do, which we've referenced in multiple categories. But it's not to be overlooked. It's, again, not something that any one person is likely to do to be able to do what you do, but multiple people can do pieces of it, most likely. Candidates are unlikely to have the traits of a founder, or an equity partner, somebody who runs their own practice or the firm as a whole, until they do it. And so it requires a thoughtful approach to be able to train them and recognize that it's not going to be something that's turnkey and very quickly. Things that make a successful attorney, as somebody who's very effective as a lawyer, are not always the traits that make them successful as firm owners or equity partners. Another challenge for internal lawyer candidates, significant challenge, is how are they going to pay for this? So we'll come back to financing a bit in the next category, but on the back of the envelope, if you've created a firm that has a significant value, people who are rising to equity partner tend to be in their 30s. They have a lot of other obligations. They may have young families, mortgages, other things. They're not going to be handing you millions of dollars overnight. It has to be something that is transitional and probably financed by the firm. We'll come back to the structure and what that looks like in a bit. But financing, selling it to internal candidates can be a challenge. Okay, let's say if that's a problem, we'll go to the third category. Merge the practice with another firm, join a larger platform. And this is probably the least likely to work. It has a lower value because you're not even really selling something, as in the first category, where you expect to get some type of a premium for what you've created. You're just joining another firm. And that alleviates a lot of the headaches of running the firm and owning the firm, and obviously the liabilities. But then you have a boss, and it's not that different from just winding down your practice in terms of value that you can expect to receive. It probably puts you as a founder or an equity partner who's been running your own practice for a long period of time in a management structure that does not fit because nobody has told you what to do for a long time and you're not in the mood for it. It can be very beneficial to clients, depending on where you go, and it can be very protective of them, and that is a goal. But it often leaves non-equity partners out of the process. So you're not likely to protect other people at your firm because there may be other people at the new firm who can do what these folks do, and they may need to work to do. And if you plug in, that can create significant uncertainty for the people at your firm. And again, it could be a terrible fit for your clients. Maybe they don't want to be at a huge firm. Maybe they don't want to pay different rates. Maybe they don't want to have the person that is designated to take over the practice be in charge of their stuff. Or maybe they have actual conflicts with that firm, which would obviously be something that would have to be vetted. But it's a significant problem that can be pretty tricky to manage. Clients chose you for a reason and they don't really want to have other choices imposed on them. Okay, the fourth category is something that lawyers typically don't really think about. And it is emerging and it takes a little more creativity and can be something that will take some analysis to determine whether it fits well for your practice, but it should be on the table because there is flexibility that comes from this that can be difficult to get in the other three categories. And it is creating a law-related business that owns firm operations, and when you do that, you can sell that, including to non-lawyers. This obviously is a much better fit for certain types of practices than others. If you have, again, an active trial practice where it's personal to you and you're the star trial lawyer, it's really relatively unlikely that it's going to be seamless to transfer. And the operations of the firm consist of very specific trial work that varies depending on the case and what is required. And from year to year and from month to month, the different cases that go to trial are vastly different than each other, and you can't really plan around it. But for other types of practices where there is a steady stream of revenue, a predictable workflow, a repeatable staff level sort of workload that can be made more efficient, for example. Or if there's a significant marketing operation related to the practice, for example, in high level PI work, high volume PI work, that definitely is the type of thing where there's a lot of operation work that's driving value for the firm, which is not something that only a licensed person can do, meaning a lawyer. And if those things that are business functions that are critical to the value of the firm can be split into a different entity, those things are not things that only a lawyer can own. Now, a law firm is. And there are downsides to this and there are opportunities to it. It should be analyzed in the context of your practice and how it would be a fit for your practice. It can be complex and the transaction is higher cost. You have to have all the documentation about how these two entities will relate to each other. That tends to be a service agreement between the non-law firm and the law firm. It can create management and administration challenges, and it requires significant diligence to ensure the compliance with the legal ethics rules. There are many legal ethics rules that this would touch, and you have to ensure not just in the way that it's set up, but in the way that it's actually managed and administered, that you comply with those rules. Of course, if it's set up, if it's a fit for the practice, and if it's set up and there are significant value in the business operations of the firm, and it's easy to see how the lawyer functions can be split into something that only licensed persons can do, it can be much easier to sell because non-lawyers can own it, and there are a lot more non-lawyers than lawyers. Again, the four categories are things that should be assessed as part of the plan to think about where does your practice fit in this structure? What options are available to you? What make the most sense? And sometimes it's the right choice to pursue a couple different options and then to see, what that looks like in practice. You may think that you have people who can take over, and so you're going to sell to internal candidates, but then you approach those people and discuss it, and it turns out they don't want to do that, or they can't do that, or they have some other plan in mind for themselves. So there are very likely one or more of these categories that would be viable for the practice, but this is the process of sort of logically planning through succession planning. Where does your practice fit in the context of these options? And then once we identify that, you're looking into the actual practical realities. I want to sell to internal candidates. Do they want to own this? Do they have the wherewithal to make it work? Because if they can't run it when you're gone, it's not going to make a difference, what they agree to do. Another significant element of this, which I referenced previously, is how will the succession plan be financed? And this is another area that is typically extremely daunting to lawyers who are thinking through these issues, because what they're really thinking about is probably an old school regime where a new equity partner, and when you became an equity partner, this may have been what you did. You go to a bank and you get a loan for the amount of buying into the firm. That money goes to the firm to purchase your interest, and the equity partners who are selling some of the interest or handing it over get that, and they reduce over time, and you buy and step up over time. So if you did that, and when you became an equity partner, it was your process. Many lawyers think that's the only possible process that's out there. And in fact, it's just one of several options, but it does still exist. It's much less likely to be a thing because you have fewer banks who are participating in this, and you also have a very different, reluctant approach for some of the rising equity partners who just don't want to be tied to that level of a specific liability for something that is not as secure as it might have been in like 1983. Clients leave, law firm fortunes change, and if you're a rising equity partner, taking out a huge loan for that, when it could change in the next day, is a fairly daunting thing. So this does happen, and it can be a great option if it's available and if the people who are buying in are open and willing to do it, for obvious reasons, because it provides cash up front, and the people who are selling and leaving the firm or stepping down their ownership of the firm get that cash, and they're ready to roll. It's less likely to be something that would be palatable to rising equity partners in 2025 for the reasons that I just mentioned, that fortunes of law firms are much more variable, partners feel much more mobile. And at the time when this was prevalent, people stayed at firms, clients stayed at firms, and it was really unlikely that either of them would leave. Well, now it's likely. And so taking out a hard liability for something that is extremely variable is a tricky concept. A second way that law firm succession plans get financed is contributed capital from new owners. And this is much more similar to self-financing. It's kind of a variation on that theme. But basically, the firm identifies some amount of contributed capital that the new equity partners should contribute. And the founders are departing equity partners over time, again, slowly. Take that contributed capital and they step down their interest in the firm. These are plans that have to take 3 to 5 years at a minimum to exercise, because you're not going to go to somebody and say, give me your whole annual distribution as a payment for contributed capital and make nothing. What you're going to do is say some percentage of that will be paid to step down my interest as an owner as I exit and step up your interest as a rising equity partner, as you enter the ownership ranks or develop more ownership from what you already have. And that's best through a really sort of slow, progressive approach. These are paid out of distributions. So if you would be entitled to get $100,000 as an equity partner, and you're going to contribute, $50 over 5 years, obviously you get back 10 every year. That's just an example of this way. Now, contributed capital doesn't have to correspond exactly to a percentage of ownership of the firm. And this touches on what we will always recommend you consult your tax advisors about, which we'll come back to in the next section. But it is not the case that if you sell 1% of the firm, you have to have it valued, and then you have to charge people that 1%. The value of a law firm is highly subjective. And what it means is really to be an equity partner, what it means is to have a claim to the profits of the firm in the future based on what we do, the work we do, or the profits that are generated from the work we do. It doesn't mean that you own 1% of all the hard assets of the firm, although you technically do. But when you combine all the hard assets of a law firm, you got a bunch of used staplers and computers that are fully depreciated and essentially worthless. Or worse, that you have to have hauled away in the event of a dissolution. So contributed capital doesn't necessarily correspond exactly to the value of the firm, because also it's extremely expensive and it's highly subjective to go out and have a firm valued. Some firms do it, and that can work. But it's also widely recognized now that what you're really getting as an equity partner, the identity of being an equity partner, is that you have ownership and management of a firm, control in its governance, and a right to participate in its profits. That's how you get paid. Which is the other category of how these succession plans get structured, financed, and it's owner financing, which is I have $100,000 in equity in the firm, say, and I've got five people who are going to take over. I'm going to give them equal parts over 3 to 5 years, and they're going to pay me for my 100 grand between the five of them over those 5 years. Obviously, the numbers matter. If it's 100, then five of them at, 35 can probably do that over 5 years. If it's 100 million, it's really unlikely that that's going to happen, no matter how many people are coming in. And owner financing in this instance really means we've identified something that I'm going to take away from the firm as an exiting founder or an equity partner. And the new group is going to come in and they're going to pay me that over time. I'm going to step down my experience at the firm. I'm going to make sure that what I built transfers over to them, and they're going to pay me for it. And that's how you exit with internal candidates. And then, of course, you could have hybrid options that include any or all of these together, which is increasingly common. Sometimes you might have parts of it financed by a bank or a litigation finance company. You might have some of it straight ownership financing, and you might have some of it that is just contributed capital that relates to the working capital of the firm. Okay, we have a question, which is, what are the practicalities of the effect of the selling attorney dying, leaving a non-lawyer spouse when the sale consists of future payments or referrals? The rule says you can't share fees with a non-lawyer. That's the concern. Correct. This is a question that comes up a lot. The answer will be very specific to you, but what we're talking about, the general answer will be your estate would receive payment for your interest in the value of the firm. You wouldn't be just writing a check to share fees with a surviving spouse. And those are two very different things. And so, in one instance, in our view, you'd be complying with the rules. You'd simply be having your interest in the firm bought out. Your estate would receive it according to whatever terms you've defined, say in the partnership agreement or in the succession plan. And the other would be a very weird, non-compliant law firm sharing with a non-lawyer who is a surviving spouse. So it doesn't work that way. It doesn't get structured that way. But it's a valid concern. If you have no plan, it is a valid concern. Another question, how is AI likely to impact firm value over time? This is a great question. This is a significant variable that we cannot quantify. We have studied AI, and I know that COPRAC has issued guidance. And as part of issuing that guidance, you learn a little bit about AI and you know that it is the Wild West. One way that it could impact a firm over time is that if you invest a significant amount of money in an AI process that works to do something for your firm that you need done, for example, marketing, generating leads, acquiring cases, say in a PI firm, that is a non-legal function that could be sold as an asset of the firm. But if you rely on AI to do the work, you know, within the com obviously within the confines of the roles, and you don't have many other lawyers, well, you're not going to have anybody to sell the firm to because robots aren't going to buy it. And it also, it's very unclear what the value proposition would be for your firm if AI can do it. Somebody else could get AI to do it. We don't think of lawyers that way. That's not how we think about the future of AI impacting it. And that would be obviously a different CLE. But in the short term, the answer is it's likely to significantly affect the value of a firm over time. On the other hand, it's possible that it will just still be human beings making relationships and hiring lawyers that they trust, in which case, how the work gets done, whether with AI or something else, doesn't make that much of a difference in the value, because that trust relationship is where the value is actually stored. Again, though, if you have an AI system that can do something specific for the firm's functions that needs to be done, that could be a significant asset that could be sold, and that in itself could be a non-law firm asset that you can sell to anybody. All right, let's talk about some of the other factors or details related to succession planning that are really important to make this work. A significant one is really thinking through and identifying what is the right continuing role of equity partners or founders, if that's your identity at the firm, and what's the right timeline for that. It can be really challenging for equity partners to identify the right exit for themselves. We try to help clients do that by looking at many different factors, and we encourage them to think about it very broadly. But you know, we all as lawyers recognize that we've been doing this in many cases since we were 25 years old. You've been in law school, some of us, since you were 22, and your identity is being a lawyer. And in some way, you may not be able to very easily imagine what it's like not to be one. And that's really what we're talking about here, which is you're going to go and you're not going to be a lawyer, but even more important than that, you're not going to be an important person at the firm as much as you once were. This can be a very difficult transition for founders because you built something that you are a significant part of, possibly with other partners or maybe just with yourself. And when you're there, it's an intellectual engagement, but also it is prestigious. You run something and people there work for you. So addressing that is in many ways beyond the planning of just the lawyer, but it's something we encourage our clients to do with our help and then with other resources that they may want to consider. Like, do you have things to do that will be fulfilling? Or, like some of our clients, are you going to retire and then after a month really want to come back or want to undo that? And what is the right timeline for you to retire? Do you want to die at your desk at 90? That's not a very realistic goal, but it could be done if you structure it properly. Or do you want to go tomorrow to the golf course and never come back? Also, not a very realistic goal. Something in between those two, that those vast extremes is probably more realistic. But one of the things that we do encourage clients to think through is, what are you going to do? You've been this for a long period of time, and something really specific. A successful lawyer. And so you need to think about what that's like when you're done. Client and talent retention should also dictate the timing. If you're saying that you want to do this over 20 years, and the people that work for you are themselves 60, that's not going to be, a tremendous incentive for them to move up. They may have other goals in mind. We have had instances where people are talking about succession planning, and the lawyers they'd like to hand it over to themselves are ready to retire. So client and talent retention is really significant. The client retention depends on how specific it is to you and what it means for you to transition this over time. It can't be done overnight. It doesn't have to take 10 years, but it does take time to get clients introduced to new people, to have them comfortable with new people making decisions, to train the new people to, handle the clients and get to know what they need in a really specific way. But it shouldn't take forever. Buyers tend to have a much faster timeline than sellers. Sellers who are at the firm usually want the firm transition to take, an orderly path and wind them down. And buyers are basically like, let's flip the switch and I own this now and I can do whatever I want with it. And then how much training really would be required to make the new buyer successful, whether that's internal candidates or others. Is that going to take a significant amount of time beyond what you want to do in your exit? Another category of really important elements of this is what are the tax considerations that you have to think about in the structure of the plan? We're not tax lawyers, but we do frequently recommend that all our clients consult with their tax advisors so that the tax structure that it results from the structure that you decide as part of this whole planning process, your goals and how it's set up and other things actually work for you from a tax perspective. And employment advice is also significant too. In some instances where you are downsizing a firm and selling it to somebody, or if you're in a professional corporation and some people also happen to be employees of the PC. Legal and ethics advice and regulatory advice obviously is going to be significant in the context of the category where you're selling it to a non-law firm, where you're splitting some non-legal assets or assets of the firm operations that are not something that only a licensed person can do. You really need to be mindful of how those rules interact with what you're doing, how it's administered, and what is compliant, because it makes no sense to do that if you're immediately violating significant rules. Another significant factor is how the risk exposure for you as an exiting partner is balanced, how you transition management control, and what those two things do in relation to each other. If you're not in charge of anything anymore, are you still liable for them? What is the ownership and liability percentage as balanced against the management and control function? You typically want them to correspond really closely with each other, meaning the less control you have, the less liability you should have. And so the plan should work that way. It steps you down, it steps other people up on both of those categories, up and down, in concert. Another significant category is, well, whether there are founders or equity partners who are at the same stage. Maybe you founded a firm with five other law school roommates and you've had a great run and you have a great practice. It's very unlikely that you're all really willing, ready to able to do a retirement or something as an exit at the same time. Again, some people want to work till 90 and some people are done at 55. And everybody has different financial situations as well that might dictate options that may not be available to all. So are the founders who are in the firm with you going to do the same thing on the same time frame? And if not, are you giving your ownership interest to them? They're going to buy you out? Or is it some combination of new people plus them? And will that work? And when you have equity partners who've been with you for a long period of time, which many law firm owners do, it's important to think about what the timing is vis-a-vis the other colleagues and peers that you have. Assuming that each, person can figure out the right transition for them individually, How does that affect what the other people are going to do in terms of timing? And how does the split happen with ownership? Is all the ownership going to go to the other people, in which case you still have a bunch of people who are not owning significant portions of the firm? Or can it be done in some way where everybody steps out just over a different time period? And how will or how can the firm change if the founders or the equity partners who are controlling most of it leave at different times? It's frequently the case that some of the founders or equity partners who run firms split among themselves the functions of managing the firm and generating work and doing other things. If one person in that group leaves, you may need somebody else to step into that role who is more junior, and that can lead to some tricky balancing because some people who have been in charge for a long period of time might now be working with and possibly training people who've never done it. And maybe they're not in the mood for that. So the timing between equity partners who are at the same level and may want to exit, but on different time frames, is a significant thing to think about when you're putting a plan together. And not all these answers are going to be very obvious, and some of them won't be determined. But leading to the next section, what contingency planning should be built into the plan? We've identified in the materials a few different things that do happen, and we have experience with different clients. What if a selling equity partner changes their mind during the plan or after the plan? And they say, want to come back and practice law and possibly compete with the buyer. That creates a significant problem. What if a buyer or a new equity partner who's going to step in and own more changes their mind during the plan? This also creates a significant problem because what if they leave during the plan? They're going to say buy in over 5 years' time. They start doing that and then they leave in year three. What do they get back? What do they own? What obligations do they have to the firm? What happens to the founder who's not getting bought out? These are things that really need to be integrated into the plan, and we like to put them into partnership agreements, but they can also be put into other planning documents because it does happen. Things change, people move, people's goals change, health changes for lawyers, and it's predictable that sometimes people will start a plan for the transition and not be able to finish it or not want to finish it. So we need to plan ahead for that. What if clients leave during the plan? You got a transition plan where five of us are going to buy you out in over 5 years' time, but the main firm client is gone and the revenue with it. This is where the planning really gets very specific. What happens if the revenue isn't what we expect? We build in certain ratchets so that the payments and the other obligations change. Sometimes that happens because of cash flow, which is temporary, and then payments may be deferred. Sometimes it happens because if a client leaves, there isn't going to be the value that we thought there was going to be. And so what are we paying you for? What if the new equity partners who are buying in and rising cannot successfully own or manage the firm without you, if you're an exiting equity partner? This is one of the main risks that you take in structuring these deals as an exit. And we address these really specifically. It's a balance between how much you get paid up front versus how much you get paid over time. And as a person who's leaving, you want to get all the money up front and just walk out. But as a person who's buying in, it's better for you to have this happen over time so that you can ensure that you get the training that you need, that you have the resources while the other person is still involved in the liability and the operations of the firm. And that you also confirm that what you thought was going to happen in terms of the business does happen, meaning clients do transition, revenue is transferable, that you're able to become a principal, you're getting some value for what you're paying, and that the other person's actually going to leave. These contingencies are really critical for obvious reasons, but also they can all be addressed if you think through them and think about many different options for creating contingent planning. If something happens in this way, if these expectations aren't met, this is what we're going to do. Because it's a critical part of the planning to obviously think about the contingency that it ain't going to work the way we thought it was. And if that happens, that's okay. We just think through what should happen instead. Okay, I see that we are just about at our hour of time. I'm happy to stay on and answer any other questions that anyone has. And otherwise, I'll yield back to our host.
Alrighty then, this concludes today's presentation. Thank you so much, Daniel, for your time, and thank you so much to our guests for joining us today.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.